Accession number 30267, Reel 13.
Joe Patient, Reel 13. So, having left the RAF, Joe, was this the end of flying for you?
Well, whilst I was in the Middle East as a command test pilot, I was requested by the Egyptian government to test a couple of aircraft for them.
Yes, I think you did mention that.
And yes. As a result, they offered me, when they heard I was leaving the Air Force, they offered me the job of aviation advisor to the Egyptian government. But I wasn't employed by the Egyptian Air Force. I was employed by the Minister of War, a chap called Masiri Bey. And so I answered directly to him, although all my work was associated with the Royal Air Force, with the Egyptian Air, Royal Egyptian Air Force.
What sort of air force was that, the Egyptian?
It was quite efficient, really, but very haphazard in terms of discipline. You might... I remember I laid on an operation for them, exercise, and I found out it had been cancelled. And when I inquired why, they said, "Oh, well, it was the group captain's birthday, so we had a party instead."
Rather relaxed.
Yes, but it was the thing that was difficult. I was asked to set up a flying school with the Sea Otters that I'd purchased and had been taken over by the Egyptian. And whilst one of the pupils, is the only one, in fact, that I refused to, in other words, I grounded him. Before doing so, I got my other instructor to give him a test to see if it was a matter of personalities with myself and he. But again, he advised that he should be grounded. Unfortunately, it happened to be the brother of a wing commander, Baghdadi, who was one of the chief flying instructors in the in the Egyptian Air Force. With the result that we were often at daggers drawn with the wing commander. so much so that on one occasion when the Prince Abbas Salim asked me to negotiate the purchase of some Halifaxes from Freddie Laker, and it's quite a good story because I'm arranged with Freddie Laker to buy them for £2,000 each, and eventually when they came, I was then went back and told Prince Abbas Salim that I'd negotiated and said, "Thank you very much, Captain Patient, we'll deal with it now." Fine. Then when the Halifaxes arrived, I found out they'd been purchased for £11,000 each. However, that's the way of the Middle East, I'm afraid. And you have to get used to it. But
this would have been in Farouk's time.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, King Farouk, I met on several occasions and played cards with him on a few of them. And he is a very good gambler. And, he was made such a fuss of as a young lad. And his every whim was pandered to, that it's not surprising that he ended up as rather a lecherous, whatever you like to call him, reprobate. But
was he, as you know, the playboy the media always presented?
Oh yes, yes he was. But it was worse than that. He was he was. There are many stories about Farouk, so I won't go into them, but to his detriment, including the you might be interested in the story. It's the hierarchy in Egypt are expected to be at a certain place at a certain time, and one of those certain times was a Thursday at Gezira Palace near the pyramids, a hotel where there's an afternoon dance, and Farouk invariably used to go and cast his eye around, and if there was something that attracted him, he would send one of his equerry to ask the girl to ask him to dance, because a king can't ask somebody to dance, you see. Well, with the result, often result, that the lady concerned has wined and dined and escorted. And but if they refused, of course, which they, when I say they daren't do, it needed a lot of courage to refuse, because if they were expatriate, their visas would be cancelled and they'd be on the next plane home, and their family with them. So it was very difficult. But what I remember on one occasion, a lady was asked, and she whispered to the equerry, said, "I would very much like to, but unfortunately it's the wrong time of the month." and left and got out of it in that way. Oh, it was he was a playboy, very much so, and there are lots of rumours that he on one occasion, I did hear from good source, he fancied the wife of a certain captain. The certain captain in the army was promoted to major and sent to the Sudan, and unfortunately the chap came home unexpectedly and found Farouk in his house, and he was shot. Just as simple as that. Whether Farouk shot him or whether the guards, his bodyguard, did it, we don't know, but that's what happened to the poor fellow. So he wasn't a very nice fellow, in fact.
Were there sort of revolutionary rumblings while you were there?
Strangely enough, it was all very, very quiet. But there were certain rumours going around. But then, of course, they had a revolution, and Farouk was abdicated, and the leadership was taken over by a very nice gentleman called Naguib. Unfortunately, he was purely a figurehead for Nasser, and after a short while after that, Nasser took over control immediately. For me, it was unfortunate, because his number one was a certain wing commander, Baghdadi. And I had visions of a kilo or so of hashish being planted in my flat, and I would be definitely non persona grata immediately. So I decided that it was time to get out. And
what did you experience of the revolution, Joe?
Everyone ran amok. There was a terrible disgrace at the Turf Club. The members of the Turf Club coming out were met with their angry mob, and they set fire to the Turf Club, and they threw them back into the Turf Club. And that's a definite fact. But I got out of Egypt dressed in an Arab, and I was driven to the airport with a squadron leader, Demirdash, and my I got into my own aircraft, my consul there, and I did not, no lights, I didn't take off on the runway, I took off on the perimeter track at night and got away and went to the Jordan, where I'd been offered a job as general manager of Arab Airways. So my exodus was rather hurried, and I left a very great deal of property in Egypt that I would never be able to claim compensation for. However,
I suppose really you could have lost your life then.
I could easily have been, yes, but during the rumbles I'd managed to get my brother and my brother-in-law and my and Lucy, of course, out before this happened.
I was in Egypt.
Yes, but I got you out before I had to get out.
I was in Egypt when you left for Jordan. Well, excuse me, because I followed you.
Darling, please.
So you went to Jordan, and you see you already had a job lined up there.
Yes.
Yes, meaning you'd had connections there before.
Pardon?
You'd had connections.
Yes, the general manager of Arab Airways came to Cairo and interviewed me and offered me the job should I want it. And as I decided that this was the time to go.
So Arab Airways would have been Jordanian, would they?
Yes.
Yes. Would this have been the time of King Abdullah?
King Abdullah, of course.
What was it like then in Jordan?
Very, very, very nice indeed. Very pleasant. And the only unpleasant part of the Jordan was the Palestinian refugees, which was a very, very sad event indeed. My office staff, in fact my senior clerk, had been a high court judge in Palestine and had to leave his home and orange groves and his everything else taken over during the troubles in Palestine.
This must have been sad for you because you'd seen the earlier
yes.
events, hadn't you?
It was sad because when I first went to Palestine, I wrote back to my wife telling them how chubby and friendly everybody was, and the Jews mixed with the Palestinians and the Palestinians mixed with the Jews, and we had no problems at all. However, we must cut that. The thing that I remember most of the Jordan was, of course, the wonderful places to visit in Jerusalem, and also the most marvellous place of all, which, of course, is very difficult, Petra, the rose-red city half as old as time. I used to fly many parties down. We used to have to, nowadays I think they go in with helicopters and what have you, but in those days we had to fly down to Amman on the Persian, on the Arab coast, Aqaba coast, and then take a taxi up to Wadi Musa, and then on the horses going through the narrow defile right the way into Petra itself. And as you come out, if you time the day correctly, when the sun was shining on the Khazneh, which is the treasury, it is the most impressive sight that I could say I've ever witnessed in my life, and I've had a few. So every opportunity I got, that I used to fly them in, and I used to act as a guide, take them up to the high places where there's a sacrificial, still to this day, a sacrificial bath and trough where the blood flows through. Rather extraordinary, and you can see from the high places, you can see over into the Dead Sea. Absolutely marvellous. There are lots of very good places to visit in the Jordan, as there are in the whole of the Middle East, in fact. Then...
Did you see King Abdullah? Would you have...
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did you meet him?
Yes, but I had quite a lot to do with his son, the Emir Talal. When King Abdullah was assassinated in Jerusalem, I was actually having lunch with the Emir Talal, at his home in Jerash. Then, of course, the news came through, and immediately I had to leave. And the Malak was the emir was now Malak, which is king. But he wasn't in very good health, and whilst I was there, I had been introduced to his son Hussein, who was at Harris School at that time, or college. And before the Emir Talal was crowned king, he abdicated in favour of his son Hussein, who was very pro-British, of course, and very well liked in this country.
Did you like him?
Very much. My wife and I used to sit together at the cinema, and he would be about 2 yards away from us. Absolutely all informal and very, very, very... He didn't go around, unlike Farouk, he didn't go around with a host of bodyguards, and neither did the Emir Talal. He used to ride into Amman in his wonderful horse, dressed in Bedouin dress, absolutely magnificent to look at. Really regal man.
That the assassination of Abdullah, was that a...
It was a political thing. He was too pro-British. And as a result... the terrorists, or call them what you like, decided that it didn't change anything in actual fact, but it was rather unfortunate.
This would have been the time of Ghulam Pasha too.
Yes, Ghulam Pasha was a very nice gentleman, absolute wonderful man. His wife was extremely nice person as well. We got along very well with them, but he was very, of course, very much occupied with the armed forces there. And he was, a little while later, treated, to my mind, rather badly. He was removed from Jordan, turned to England, given a knighthood, and that was it. But
would that have been the Jordanians' fault, do you think?
No, it was the British.
It was the British, yes.
As far as I could understand, it was the political people.
Well, while you were there, Joe, what was the situation regarding the Palestinians? Were they creating problems for the Jordanians?
They weren't at that time. They were very much refugees. They were causing problems in as much as they were occupying these refugee camps. And it was really pathetic if you visited these, which I did on many occasions. And one extraordinary thing happened to us. We had a lovely elderly lady maid and a charming person.
Jay, would you mind, because it makes it crackle.
Oh.
If you, sorry about that, I have to nag you.
The and her family came up from the Jordan Valley, and the weather at the time was really, really bad. So I took my car out of my garage and allowed the family to shelter and stay until they could get organized. They were so grateful. I was very embarrassed. They literally fell and kissed my feet, sort of thing, which made me feel awful that I couldn't do anything better for them. They have every reason to resent the happenings that went on, and mainly political, from unfortunately, from my point of view, the mishandling of the whole Israeli Palestinian fiasco, I would call it.
Yes, because you saw a lot of the origins of that as well,
yes.
Didn't you, Joe? Was there aid going in at that time?
Any
aid going into Jordan?
There was a lot of aid going into Jordan, but it was going in the usual way and into the wrong places, and the aid persons, of course, all every single one of them had to have their own car, and they wouldn't double up to go down to the Jordan, to the refugee camps and so on, which was absolutely typical American and typical Jew.
And how about the Air Force, your job with Arab Airlines?
I had nothing to do with the Egyptian with the Jordanian Air Force.
Oh.
Only the civil airline.
Yes. That was Arab Airways.
That was Arab Airways, yes.
And that was sort of just ferrying between countries, wasn't it?
It was doing mostly between Beirut, Damascus, and Egypt, but mostly Beirut. There was very little flying between the others.
And I suppose this would be, we're talking about the 1960s now, are we, Joe? Would this be the...
No, 50s.
1950s, late 1950s. Yes. This would have been a quiet time in Beirut, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. It was, yes. Mm. Then I eventually... Then the Arab Airways was in financial trouble, and I negotiated with Aden Airways for the British to take over, and sadly for me, the Aden Airways promised me a job with Aden Airways and offered me £4,000 for my shares that I had in Arab Airways. I was then asked to go to discuss this with Sir Charles Belgrave in London, which I did, and he just put me off again, and then I got a telegram: offer you £1,000 for your shares, regret, no post available, Aden Airways. Whilst I was away, they'd carried some form of meeting of other shareholders and transferred the shares, etc., into a holding company. I don't know the actual detail. All I know is I was done out of a job, and also, however, it wasn't too bad, because I was offered a job in Beirut with Contracting and Trading Company as an aviation manager there. It was a very pleasant job, that was. We used to fly mostly to Baghdad and various parts of Iraq and what was then Persia, and also to Turkey. We had a few trips, mostly carrying engineers and so on and so forth.
You were very privileged to have seen Baghdad before this happened.
Oh, yes.
Before the war. What was it like?
It was a very, very, very nice place. My wife enjoyed it too. They had a rest house that in Baghdad. The company owned a rest house in Baghdad. So we were able to travel around and see the various sort of sites. Then something rather unusual happened. I was getting quite staid at that time and sort of, if you like, elderly. And then my wife surprised me by telling me that we were going to have another child, which after 13 years I thought I'd found out what caused it. But however, it was a wonderful thing. It completely rejuvenated me, and I really, really went overboard, if you like, with delight eventually when the child was born. Absolutely marvellous little girl.
Would the child have been born
in Beirut? Yeah.
Lovely.
And unfortunately, my wife then suffered badly with her back and had to be sent home to UK for an eventual operation for a laminectomy, and which meant, of course, that I would also go back and try my luck in UK. I had by this time exchanged my consul with Arab Airways for a Rapid, and then when I went to Beirut I changed my Rapid for a Gemini. And I had at the time also a Chrysler Ace, which I also had in Beirut, and left it there intending to go back and collect it a little later. Unfortunately then, after we left Beirut, before I could go back, I received a telegram from my friend, the engineer, to say, don't bother to come back. There's been a revolution and your aircraft is riddled with with holes. So that was another loss, of course.
What date would that have been when you came back?
Pardon?
What date would that have been? Would this have been now going into the 1960s?
No. I should have got my logbook.
I've got to return to the UK in 1955.
55.
Yes, that's what I've got a note of.